Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Today's conversation centers around yoga, and while the practice is familiar to many, indulge me nonetheless. Briefly, yoga is an ancient physical and spiritual discipline that originated in India more than 5,000 years ago. It means union in Sanskrit and uses breathing techniques, exercise, and meditation to provide health and mental well-being. There are many schools of yoga. Two examples: Raja, which emphasizes exercise of the mind; Hatha, which emphasizes exercise of the physical body. Charlotte Stone, my guest today, certainly buys into that. She is the founder and director of the Stone Center for Yoga and Health in Teaneck, New Jersey. It is, in her words, a tranquil sanctuary where people of all ages can retreat from the daily stresses of life and at the same time discover healthy, mindful ways to nurture body, mind, and spirit. Charlotte embarked on her yoga journey more than 40 years ago as a student at the University of Zurich, where she was studying English and comparative medieval literature. Life got stressful for Charlotte, an athlete who was putting herself through school. And that's when she was introduced to yoga, an introduction that changed her life and eventually her career path. We'll get to all that in a minute. Charlotte has certifications in structural yoga therapy, Phoenix Rising Yoga Therapy, cardiac yoga, and wellness coaching. She's completed several professional trainings, including a comprehensive treatment strategy for osteoporosis and mindfulness-based stress reduction. She's also the director of integrative yoga therapeutics for Kula for Karma, a nonprofit based in New Jersey that integrates therapeutic yoga, meditation, and stress management into mainstream medicine and healthcare. Her teaching comes within the heart of her own practice as she shares her adaptive yoga style and path of self-discovery. Charlotte, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Talk about life before yoga. What about the practice attracted you, and why?
I was a student at the University of Zurich, where I was living, and was working in an advertising agency, which was very stressful, to put myself through school. I was studying a topic that nobody was interested in, which was English and comparative medieval literature, which nobody studies, but it's highly useful. I don't know how, but I'm sure someone will figure it out one day. And I was also pretty athletic, so I was doing weightlifting and swimming, loving all of that. And my friends informed me that I was driving them crazy and I had to do something to reduce my stress so that I could reduce theirs.
Why were you driving them crazy?
I was really stressed out. I was running from one place to another. I had a little apartment with a bunch of girls, and I had to pay that rent, and I had to, you know, pay for the university because my parents didn't pay for that.
Can we just go back for a second? Why were you in Switzerland?
Okay. I was born in Philadelphia, and when I was about 10 years old, my father, who was Swiss, decided to go back to his homeland. So he went back to Zurich for 1 year and decided to stay. He was a professor at the university there. He was teaching at the Polytechnicum. And he decided we would stay. My mother was German, so she was comfortable with the German language. And I had to learn German, and then I had to learn Swiss German because they don't really like foreigners in Zurich. So mm-hmm. I had to learn all those different languages. So we stayed from, I guess I was 10 when we got there, until about 1977 when I came back to the United States. So in my heart of heart, I guess I'm both American and European, all in one.
So you really had to make several adjustments.
Sure.
Living there, going to school,
right.
You know, recreating yourself in a sense.
Right. And I spent 1 year in the American English school. It was sort of an international school for a bunch of international brats. Then they switched me to the Swiss school system, which was a phenomenal education. So I was very fortunate. I didn't love it in the beginning, but I came to love it. And the university there was very mind-broadening, not to mention the fact that this was by now the 70s, which was very mind-broadening for many people. And so that's how I became involved with yoga and meditation.
Because you were driving people crazy.
I was driving people crazy. I was making everybody stress with my own stress. I was talking too fast. I wasn't getting any sleep because the papers had to be written, so I'd write them at night. That's become a lifelong habit that I'm still trying to fix. So a friend introduced me to yoga through a book that was translated at the time from English, which was its original language, into German, which by then I had become more comfortable with. And I think it's Richard Hittleman's 28 Days to Yoga Mastery. I still have it. All the pages are falling out. It's a riot in German. And it has, you know, the women with sort of the pantaloon type of gym pants that people wore then. And men had those funny short shorts on. And I thought, okay, I will master yoga in 28 days, because that's the kind of competitive, crazy person that I was at the time. Of course, not now anymore. After 28 days, I could now reach my knees when I stretched. I could possibly reach my shins. And I realized I have not mastered yoga. And I was furious with yoga. I was angry, but I was also intrigued.
Why can't I get this? Or I should get this.
Exactly. I'm an athlete. It's a program. I did what he said. I did it every day. I did my stretches. I couldn't understand why I couldn't reach my toes and look like the pictures looked.
Mm-hmm.
That should have given me a clue right there that was another way to do yoga than that. But I didn't really get it then. I looked at it as a stretch program. I didn't investigate anything further. I had no idea about mind-body healing. That all came later. And so after 28 days, I decided, well, I guess I should continue this. So I did the whole 28 days again. There was no Google then. There was no looking stuff up.
You weren't in a class. You were doing this solo.
No, I was doing this on my own in my little room in my mansard upstairs in this house that we had all rented. And I did find some people who were doing a little yoga here and there. There wasn't like very formal anything going on at the time. There were some Indians who were teaching a little bit. So I picked up a class once in a while with them and didn't know what I was doing, and I was angry at the yoga and angry with myself that I couldn't master this thing. Why could I not reach my toes in a forward bend? I felt that that was an inexcusable failing. And so I figured I flunked yoga. But there was something about it that made me stick with it.
As opposed to just saying, screw yoga.
Right. And I couldn't understand why I didn't do that, because I might have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I tried Mahjong and said, screw that. I can't do that. So I don't know. There was something about it that I just felt I should be able to do this. I should be able. There's something about this that is good for me. That I got. Because there was a certain peacefulness that I would get when I would practice. And when I went to class and someone else led it, you know, I would hide somewhere in the back and try to do my best. And they kind of emphasized not making yourself too crazy with it. There was something about that message that did appeal to me, because I was making myself crazy everywhere else. So I kind of stuck with it, with my own practice, practicing with these people a little bit, with some people that were just around. Zurich is very much a center of the universe. And so a lot of international travelers come through. There were a lot of influences. There were a lot of Indians who were sharing this practice, but there was no formal training. There was nothing to study. So I love that, but hated it too. And I knew there's something about it that I'm not getting.
Right.
So still very stressed, and now being competitive about yoga, which is kind of a joke now that I look back 40-something years later. I had no clue that I would ever teach this. You don't wake up in the morning and think, this is my career path.
Of course.
I'm going to teach yoga for
of
a living.
Course.
That comes way later. So very stressed out still, another friend of mine drags me, kicking and screaming. He says, you know, meditation is all the rage now. We should go to this lecture tonight. There's a lecture at the university about meditation. And I said, well, I don't know what that is. But it was the time of Timothy Leary and
sure.
Ram Dass, and even
mm-hmm.
we in Switzerland had heard of that. You know, the 70s arrived a little later in the hinterlands of the Alps. So he dragged me to this meditation lecture, which was on transcendental meditation. And I thought, this is the weirdest thing. We're closing our eyes. We're sitting cross-legged with our hands on our knees. I kept peeking with one eye thinking, maybe everybody left and I'm sitting all alone in a room. But they were all there and they spoke about mantras, and they said that if they gave you a mantra, you could never share it with anybody because,
right.
you know, then they would have to like kill you or put you, I don't know,
right.
in a prison with all the other mantra sharers. I don't know. I thought it was kind of interesting and weird, a lot like what I
felt
about
yoga. But you were intrigued.
I was intrigued. There was a moment, maybe just a moment, that I felt quieter. And then, of course, in shock, I realized, I think I haven't had a thought in at least a half a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked around to see if anybody else looked that way, or if I had maybe levitated or fallen asleep, which is a distinct possibility.
I totally relate to that, because
yeah?
I had the same experience with TM. And, of course, I forgot my mantra.
I don't remember my mantra anymore.
Well, that's
okay.
And
I've gotten others over the years. And I thought, between the yoga and the meditation that I was diligently trying to do, I kept thinking, what a colossal waste of time. What a luxury. I could be working and earning money per hour. I could be going to a class. I could, you know, we paid like 2 francs for the yoga class at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I could be doing something else. I could be writing a paper. I could be studying. I could be working. I could be writing copy for the advertising agency. What am I doing? So what I started to do in the yoga classes was leave for the relaxation, which is, you know, the ultimate sin. It's called Shavasana, the relaxation pose. Or corpse pose. I don't like that, so I call it relaxation pose. And I would like quietly roll up my mat and leave. And they told me that was not appropriate. But I just thought 10 minutes to sit here or lie here and do nothing. What a silly waste of time. I thought mm-hmm. it was a colossal waste mm-hmm. of time. And it took me many years to understand that that's probably the most important thing you could do. Later, when I studied with other yoga masters, they said if you had one pose to do, that would be the pose, that relaxation at the end, those 10 minutes of peace and quiet, because that's when your whole nervous system calms down and you become, you know, like a normal human being again or something close to that anyway. I didn't like that until many years later.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Charlotte Stone, who is the founder and director of the Stone Center for Yoga and Health in Teaneck, New Jersey. So you're kind of connected to yoga while you're in Zurich, but it
yes.
doesn't really become a huge part of your life until you come back to the States.
Yes.
First of all, why did you come back to the States? Maybe you always knew that that was going to happen. And then how did yoga take over your life?
I came back to the United States.
After how many years in Zurich?
It was 1977, mm-hmm. so quite a long time. I came here because when you do a humanities degree in Zurich, they like it that you spend a half a year abroad exploring whatever you want to explore. And so I came here because I had no money. I had an aunt who lived in New York, and I figured I'll just live with my aunt and uncle. That'll be great. I'll go to City University and pursue my master's program maybe a little bit here in comparative medieval literature. And I'll do that for a half a year, and then I'll go back after that first semester. But I met the person who's now my husband, and he said, oh, you're not going back there. And so I stayed another semester and another, and of course, by 1978, we were married.
Mm-hmm.
And I transferred my credits to here, and I pursued my master's thesis is on the Chanson de Roland. It's about medieval...
The Song of Roland.
The Song of Roland.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a piece that was written around 1100. I just loved that world, but I knew you can't make a living doing this. I didn't want to be a professor. And so I started to work in advertising and marketing here and still loved the yoga. So I was doing it on my own. And wherever we lived, I had some girlfriends.
So you
they
hadn't
would come
given
over.
It up here.
Not at all.
Okay.
It still was that practice that I would go to calm myself and to stretch and get a little bit of a workout.
So you got more comfortable.
Well, I kept going deeper with it.
Mm-hmm.
It drew me more and more as life started to happen. And, you know, while I was still in Zurich, I felt that I wanted more information about yoga. So I started to sit in on anatomy courses that my friends were doing. For example, my medical student friends or my roommate who was a physical therapy student. And I felt that I should know more. When I came here, I continued to study and read. I realized, oh, there's a whole philosophy behind this. Why that hadn't occurred to me before, I don't know. And there was one more influence in Zurich that translated over to here. While I was still in Zurich, I was exposed to an exhibit at the Historical Society of the University that was on Tibet and the art of the Himalayas, kind of like the Rubin Museum does here. On a much smaller scale. I was invited to come to look at this exhibit, and I walked in, me, a nice Jewish girl who grew up in a kosher household. I walk into this exhibit on Tibet and on Buddhism, and I just found a peacefulness. I cannot explain this to you,
mm-hmm.
but there was something that just touched me about the philosophy of being present to this one moment as it arises and falls away. So I started to read about that. And that carried me through to the United States. It steadied me. So I had yoga, I had meditation, I had this idea of the teachings of Buddhism. I'm certainly not a Buddhist, but the teachings, the wisdom stayed with me. And I had one more practice that I brought with me from Zurich, and that was Feldenkrais. Dr. Moshe Feldenkrais was an Israeli physicist who came up with a very organic way of moving our bodies that was comfortable. I don't know why that spoke to me since I was doing all this crazy stuff, but it helped me later when I became injured. So when I came to the United States, you know, after a few years, we had some kids, and I got a job first in New York, and then when I had the kids, we lived in Riverdale, New York at the time. So I got a job with a focus group moderator, first just listening to her, writing out, remember tapes? We'd listen to tapes.
Of course.
And writing out quotes from the focus groups. And out of that came a really wonderful job. I became an analyst and a writer. I would write to ghostwrite, you know, reports and presentations for her. And she trained me to be a focus group moderator, which is qualitative research. I loved it. I traveled around the country. I would write. And then I had a life-transforming moment. I had a close encounter on the George Washington Bridge with a tractor trailer, and he won and I lost, and I had to stop traveling and writing. I just couldn't do anything. I had a lot of injuries, and I had to spend 8 months in physical therapy. It was a really tough time, and that's when yoga really called and was there for me.
Came to the front burner of your mind.
It certainly did, because I couldn't do anything. I was going to physical therapy, and after a few months of that, they cleared me to do a little bit of yoga. I could barely raise my arm, let alone do a lotus pose anymore. So I went to Kripalu a little bit to heal, which is a wonderful center in Lenox, Massachusetts, and found that I could do nothing. And that was very depressing, having come from this very athletic practice that I thought I was going to do for the rest of my life, and realized, well, what the hell do I do now? So I had taken a training in Phoenix Rising Yoga Therapy. I decided I wanted to be a little more professional about my yoga work. And if I'm going to teach people, I should know a little more about it. And it was a wonderful, wonderful training. I always do the weirder thing first and then the normal thing. Mm-hmm. So instead of just being a yoga teacher like you're supposed to do, I decided I'm going to be a yoga therapist. And then I became a certified teacher later on. So this Phoenix Rising Yoga Therapy program introduced me to a very pivotal teacher in my life. She taught anatomy at this training, and I called her after my car accident and said, what am I going to do now? I don't know how to do anything. I can't move. I can't stretch. I can't bend. I can't even breathe right. And she said, now you're going to become a really good yoga teacher. And I said, what are you talking about? I can't do anything. She said, well, now you're going to watch your students. You're going to observe them much more keenly. You will articulate better, and you'll stop putting on this beautiful command performance at the front of the room. That's really pretty, but that's not good teaching. So she really helped me to change my thinking about yoga and to start to understand that yoga could be a healing and transformative practice. It was a pivotal time in my life. And at Kripalu, I experienced, I would say, probably the gentlest yoga class I've ever had with a woman I'd never met before. A wonderful, wonderful teacher who basically did the whole class lying on our backs. We would stretch an arm and wiggle our fingers and take a few breaths and bring the arm down on the exhalation. And I had never experienced anything like this. I found that it was hard for me to do. I was in a sweat. This was the first step back into yoga after all those months of not being able to do anything. And I howled and sobbed the whole way through the class. This is actually normal in yoga classes. People feel things and it brings up emotions. And for me, it brought up my brokenness. What it did is it opened a door to a whole new way of looking at yoga, thinking about it and experiencing it, and then learning how to share that. So I went back to the drawing board. I got another training with this wonderful teacher who really became probably my chief teacher over the years, Mukunda Tom Stiles. And I said, you have to teach me how to teach this. He said, I'm not teaching right now. I'm just writing a book. So I said, well, could I help you edit? I'm good at that. And it gave me that first glimpse into a therapeutic approach to yoga that every human being on the planet could do. If you couldn't sit, you could lie down. As long as you could take a breath, and not even a good one, you could do yoga. That idea has stayed with me forever. I will never stop being grateful for being introduced to this concept that every human being can do a yoga practice of some kind.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Charlotte Stone, who is the founder and director of the Stone Center for Yoga and Health in Teaneck, New Jersey. So let's fast forward a little bit. Where did you get off thinking that you could open up a center?
I was working part-time as a focus group moderator, and then after that stopped, I was still a writer part-time for nonprofits. Mm-hmm. And doing this part-time yoga thing. I had two boxes with business cards. One said etched in stone, which was my little play on words for mm-hmm. my writing business. Mm-hmm. And the other said yoga for all or something like yoga for you. And the ones that said yoga kept selling. Like people keep wanting those. They kept wanting those as opposed to the ones that said, you know, writing. Even though I was a successful and a good writer and loved that, I didn't love as much as the yoga. There was something about the yoga that people kept wanting. They'd say, your voice, and I feel so relaxed when you share this with me. Could we do this before we do that meeting on strategic planning for this nonprofit?
So it really became a kind of natural act for you, unbeknownst to you, all those years ago.
Yes. I think what happened is that people called me in, and they kept pulling me in to do the yoga. I didn't recognize it at the time. And then this happened. One of the places I was teaching was in my own family room. And we kept moving the furniture around, me, you know, my friends and I. And they started to drop like a $5 bill on the table.
I was just going to ask, you just did it. Come on over and we'll do yoga.
Initially, yes. They said, well, when do you do yoga? And mm-hmm. I would say, well, I do it a lot. But after a while, they said, well, if we're going to do this regularly, we're going to pay you something. And they would leave $2 or $5 on the table. And I said, I don't want that. They decided they're getting sick and tired of moving furniture around. They just felt, you know what, you got to open up a studio. And I said, that's ridiculous. I can't. I don't know how to run a business. And but I had a good friend at the time. And so together we opened up a yoga studio in Teaneck, New Jersey. And I figured, you know what, I'll do almost anything once. I'll try it for a year. And if it doesn't work, I'll just go back to doing whatever
I do. And this is
2000, around then.
Okay.
And it never was bad. It was always a good thing. We never lost money. We started with a student. Some people who had gotten word of where I had landed followed me there.
Just you?
No, it was me and this friend of mine. We became business partners.
Oh, okay.
And we ran that studio for 5 years. We started to do a teacher training. People started to come because there were people in the world, it turned out, who also were injured and broken and had stress. And they found this kind of yoga appealing. We had some strong classes, and then we had classes for stress and healing. And those were the classes that really took off.
Do you get offended if somebody uses the term with yoga as faddish?
No, I understand it really well. I think some people really saw yoga as a trend. They should get over it.
Trend, that's a better word.
It's been around for a long, long time. So I think we have to get over the idea that it's just trendy.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still trendy because there's always like some cool chic yoga thing coming around the bend that's different and new and sexy and exciting. Because in the West, we like different and new and sexy and exciting. So it certainly has a fad feel to it. And there are devotees of all different styles of yoga. There's yoga that is sort of what I think of as for the young and the restless, you know, the yoga that could kill you. But it's really fun. I think if you're healthy and you can do these crazy practices and put a foot behind your neck
and stand
on your two hands and, you know, that's cool too. I don't think there's any bad yoga. I think that some of the yoga has become trendy because it looks pretty.
Uh-huh.
It's very moving to see a room full of yogis moving, whether it's a strong flow yoga class or in a hot yoga class where everybody's sweating or in a class that's very contemplative and calming. There's something incredibly beautiful about it and you feel good doing it. So I think you have to find what floats your boat. You have to find the practice that's right for you. For some people, it's a really powerful flow. For some people, it's going to be an Iyengar type of practice that is very focused on, you know, two or three movements in a pose that you will focus on for an hour and really study and understand it really, really well. I respect that teaching a lot. Some of it is very breath-based. That's kind of the yoga that I like. You inhale, you do this. You exhale, you do that. But you do it with a calmness about it. And some people are drawn to that more meditative, mindful style.
For me, it's so hard to let my mind go blank.
Me too.
Really? I mean, are you having yoga experience, you think, oh God, I got to get to the supermarket and I better write down that I need butter.
Yes.
And that's okay?
Yes.
Because it makes me a little nuts, you know, that I don't think that I'm getting out of it what I need to get out of it.
I love it that you shared that because I think that's really universal. I don't think anybody walks into the yoga studio, sits down, takes three deep breaths
and
then has a blank mind and goes to, I don't know, someplace in nirvana and mm-hmm. yoga heaven.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you're describing is exactly how we all are. And we've kind of been sold on this idea that we should be different, that somehow the shopping list goes away and then we have a really quiet mind and it's just this completely blank canvas in there. What it actually is more like a movie screen with a lot of pictures flowing through. I think what yoga does is it helps us to be able to have sort of a calm abiding with whatever comes through the mind. In other words, to not write a whole Hollywood script around it, to not get involved in, all right, so what is on the shopping list? Let me go further with the shopping list. I think I forgot to buy the tissues. Oh, wait a minute. I wonder if the car, oh, I was going to get the tire change. That's what starts to happen to us. What yoga helps us to do is recognize this spinning out and bring us back to the present moment, usually through the breath or through another movement, which calls you back home again, what I think of as home on the yoga mat. So yes, we're all going to have those thoughts. The difference is what we do with them. You know, it's kind of like that commercial that shows that, you know, if you have this brand of car, it's all green lights and smooth sailing and the West Side Highway has no other cars on it. we expect that to be our yoga state of mind or the meditative state of mind. It's not like that. Nobody gets a lane with only green lights.
Should everybody practice yoga? Let me rephrase that. Who shouldn't practice yoga?
Actually, I think everybody can practice yoga. I don't think they have to, but I think it's a healing practice that everyone can do.
And in the same breath, why are there more women who practice yoga than men?
That's a good question.
And you don't know the answer to that?
I don't know the answer to that. There are very famous male teachers.
Okay.
Many of whom
yeah.
are very good, some of whom are not that great, and maybe should get their ethics checked. But there are more women than men doing this. I don't know why. I wonder. It's a really good inquiry.
You haven't thought about this?
I have thought about it because I would love for more men to attend class. I wonder if men think that it's wimpy
mm-hmm.
or that it's just something that, you know, cool chicks do in tight leotards. Well, then maybe they should go and watch. I don't know. Maybe
exactly.
that would be a good thing. Of course, we don't do that in our studio. We wear pretty much what my mother calls pajamas. But I think it has become a practice that's very chic. It looks pretty. You can buy really gorgeous, very expensive yoga clothing. It's become almost like a fashion statement to have your yoga mat of a certain brand and go into a yoga class where you're sort of mat to mat to mat. That's very much a New York phenomenon. You know, the classes are packed. And to do this very pretty looking yoga. And I think men don't think they're going to get a workout out of it. And they seem to think that they should. So they'll go to the gym. And what we find when we do get these guys into the class is that even if they're super athletes, we get a lot of cyclists, golfers, they'll recognize that yoga, it's kind of where I began my journey. Yoga is a really good stretch. And if for nothing else, that's why they should show up. And some of them, that's what sells them on it in the beginning. But I think the image of yoga is that it's this kind of light level workout that they're not going to really find themselves
that's
challenged by.
That's so funny, though, because I felt initially intimidated by yoga, not by looking at these poses where, you know, you're on your back and your feet are up against the wall or whatever it is. I mean, I thought, I can't do this. And I am athletic, although I'm getting older and the joints are not the way they used to be. But I was very intimidated by that. And I wonder if men would be embarrassed. I can't do this.
I'm sure you're right about that. Sometimes when I talk to guys, they'll say, you know, I wish I could do yoga, but I can't touch my toes. Or I wish I could do yoga, but I can't sit in lotus. And you know what I say to them? I say to them, I can't do it either. And you don't have to. What people don't know is that there's no requirement, there's no prereq to get into yoga. And people think there is. You know, they look at these classes like you. You're looking at poses that you think that's not, normal people can't do that. So I think it scares people. And I think it has people who might benefit kind of running the other way because they don't think they can do that and they don't think they want to.
I also wonder if there's a concern that you have to like sort of buy into the whole yoga experience. There's this whole philosophy behind it and maybe people just don't want to do that.
That's true too. And that might be a turnoff as well, because yoga does have part of its image is that it's, you know, shrouded in the mists of the Himalayas and India and you know, oh, it's this weird spiritual practice or it's a religious practice.
Sure.
And that pushes people away. And so I think people who are in the Western yoga world work very hard to dispel that image. But not everybody does that, or not everybody's paying attention. You know, it still might have that aura. And some places actually kind of push that aura. You know, there's chanting at the beginning of classes, which once you're in and you kind of get what it is, it can be quieting and centering. But for some people, it's a big turnoff.
We've run out of time, but I wanted to ask you just one more thing. What do you see for yourself and yoga and your practice in the future or your business?
I hope that I'll always be able to do some kind of yoga, and I believe that I will. I have more and more gotten involved with teaching teachers and training and mentoring yoga therapists, which is a fairly new field that I hope will gain more recognition. I'd love to do my part to help that field to grow. So I'd like to make contributions there. For my business, I see that as a transition. I'd love to present more at conferences. I'd love to share what I know, this deep love of anatomy and the soul, with more and more people so that they can go and share a yoga practice that is accessible to everyone, not just some people, not just the pretty, tall, flexible, healthy,
Lululemon wearing.
I wasn't going to say that. But yes, not just the small segment of the population, but my passion is to share yoga and help people teach yoga who are excited about teaching people in hospitals or teaching people who have injuries, so that our yoga needs to be very informed about these different populations. And I love teaching people how to do that.
What better way to end than that? Charlotte, thanks for coming and spending this time with me today.
Thanks so much, Sandy.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.